Good evening, everybody, and welcome back to the Flicks, the Church for God. This is the fourth in a what seems to be an epic series exploring the BFI Gothic DVDs that were released recently, just in time for Christmas. And I'm going to be exploring disc two of the 70s paranormal ghostly series Supernatural. The next four episodes are on disc two, and they start off with a story called Lady Sybil. Now here, an elderly woman called Lady Sybil Manners is freaking out in her stately home because she's convinced there is a prowler creeping around her house, trying her door at night and trying to get in so he can kill her. She lives there with her two sons. One is a doctor, played by the English actor Denham Elliott, and the other is a struggling musician, played by the playwright John Osborne. And in the midst of this, in the doctor's study is a chameleon, which seems to be the source of much intellectual riffing and reflection on the part of the brothers. Now, I must say that I found this episode, this is the weakest episode of the whole set, in my opinion. And it probably didn't help that I had to watch it in bits, partly because I just happened to see this late at night when I was so shattered that I fell asleep two nights running watching it. I'm not sure that says as much about the caliber of the drama, but more about the fact that I was just exhausted at the time. But still, ultimately, I felt it was a forgettable episode. The performances, though, were good. Denham Elliott does well in the role, and particularly towards the end, it's quite cool. But I think it's Lady Sybil herself, which is the standout performance of the whole piece. She's played by an 88-year-old actress called Catherine Nesbitt, and she just throws everything into the role. This, to be honest, watching it, I was wondering, when was the last time I ever saw someone who was pushing 90 in a leading role in anything? And playing it with such energy and conviction, she's a standout and unique feature of, I think, an otherwise sort of forgettable installment. The next episode up is Victoria, spelt with a K. And in some ways, this episode, you could say, is one of the most accessible of the series in terms of pure horror. It's about a young girl, I think, she's 9 years old, who is coping with the death of her invalid mother, who died while they lived in Budapest. And her distant and largely disinterested dad marries another woman who looks a bit like her deceased mum, and they move to England to start afresh with very little interest shown in Victoria from her dad. He's not really particularly got any interest in her upbringing. But Victoria has another friend with her, a large doll called Rosa that was given to her in Budapest, and she talks to Rosa at night, and her stepmother starts to wonder, might the doll actually be talking back? I really enjoyed this episode because it throws in some classic jump moments and scares. The doll itself, Rosa, is really effective. My wife actually happened to be in the room at the time I was watching this, and she looked up from her newspaper and spotted Rosa on our big old 46-inch TV screen on the wall. And she said, "That doll is creepy." You know, even she could see it was a spooky image. That was a little while after she looked up and looked at the TV and said, "Peter, you really do watch some weird things," which is really quite true. But as well as the overall gothic spookiness of this episode, there is plenty of subtext going on, including, I thought, a really fascinating angle on gender and sexuality, particularly in a period in which these sorts of things would have been repressed and not talked about in polite company. In the end, there is an interesting idea put forward from the characters that perhaps the world would be better off if men stuck with men and women with women. Now, this is a strange and pretty impractical statement, but for the purposes of this story, it's got a great sense of appropriateness about it and feels like quite a subversive message in amongst the period chills and the gothic jump scares. It's definitely worth a look. I thought Victoria was a spooky, ghostly treat, and it's got like a young girl in it with the spooky English accent who, you know, you just put a little girl in a gothic setting saying, "I love Rosa. Rosa's my best friend." That sort of thing. And you've already got a recipe for creepiness. Night of the Marionettes is an episode that is on, it feels like it's on a larger scale than some of the others, only really because it's set in the Swiss mountains and there's a multi-level set in this which just feels really big. In fact, there's moments where the camera moves around the set in such a way to demonstrate that they didn't just build a little bit of a set and then rebuilt it for another shot. It's like it's a huge set that moves around, the camera moves in certain ways that you think, oh wow, all of these rooms and things seem to be set up at the same time as one another, at least part of it anyway. Anyway, it's the story of Howard Lawrence, who's this scholar, and he's with his family, and he's on a research trip, and he's trying to look into the background of Percy and Mary Shelley. He wanted to understand how such a young woman like Mary could have written a book so dark and powerful as Frankenstein or Frankenstein. And so he is retracing their steps on a journey, apparently, that they made just before she wrote the book, and so he wants to follow in their footsteps to try and learn about what her inspiration would have been for writing Frankenstein. They wind up in this isolated guest house that has, Howard notices, a distinct lack of crucifixes in the house. Maybe they're Protestants, his wife says. But there are some very strange people at this place who are the hosts, or the innkeepers, as it were, and it turns out that They have some bizarre theatrical productions that they put on with marionettes. And as the family settle in, they realize that they are actually the only guests in this house. But not only that, they start to wonder, is this even a guest house at all? Or is it something much more sinister to which they have been lured? The episode does have some creepy moments. Though the one thing I'd say lets this down is hardly its fault. It's more of a personal opinion. I just was never that into Frankenstein. Vampires, yes. Werewolves, hell yes. Those monsters do frighten me, but in my classic monster hierarchy, it definitely goes werewolves, then vampires, then Frankenstein, then the mummy right at the bottom. That's not to say there aren't some cool Frankenstein films out there. Man, Bride of Frankenstein is just brilliant. But I just don't think of Frankenstein as a scary monster. I think the idea of Frankenstein just, in essence, can feel a bit hokey and camp. Because, you know, so many people, like, back in the day would dress up and, oh, I'm Frankenstein. So that stuff feels a bit silly. And there are elements of that to this episode. However, there is plenty of depth and darkness to balance all of that out. The location feels very creepy and remote, which is testament to the power of the writing and the performances, because the outdoor shots in this are literally just black and white pencil drawings of the inn. No joke, you cut to an establishing shot of where this family is, and it's like looking at a hand-drawn picture that doesn't even have colour, it's not even a photograph. You would never see this sort of lo-fi special effect in TV today, but it's used here blatantly, and somehow it just works. The performances are odd and creepy, not least from the daughter, Mary Lawrence. She's played by Pauline Moran, who somehow manages to arrive at the inn as this wide-eyed, life-loving young girl. And she's got these weird little sort of circular glasses, you know, like John Lennon-type glasses, but smaller, think Victorian style. And she's loving life, you know. Oh, I love the snow on my face, father, she says as she swings open the doors of the inn and the shutters and the windows and lets the breezes roll down the Alps upon her face. But she can just tilt her head or open her eyes that little bit wider, and she just suddenly looks very freaky. Honestly, there is something about this woman's eyes and teeth and her expressions that are creepier than anything else in the episode. This is not a comment on this woman, by the way. It's just she acts creepy, and she tilts and moves her face in a way that makes it spooky. It's no surprise to me that she was later cast as the woman in black in the ITV version of that novel, which perhaps for me is the scariest rendition of that particular tale. And she plays this with a similar sense of unhinged creepiness. She plays the ending as well so brilliantly that it did send a shiver down my spine. Add to that hints of incest and necrophilia, and you have a very dark and bizarre episode, Night of the Marionettes. It's certainly worth a look. Now, the last episode on this disc is called Dora Bella, and it tells a pretty intense story of two young men. Walter Van Lamont and Philip Hambleton are on their travels seeking out adventures and thrills when they meet into the beautiful and mysterious Lady Dorabella at an inn one night. Now, Walter is completely smitten by her, and ever the loyal friend, Philip, stays with Walter as the story progresses, and he is just trying to convince Walter to leave Lady Dorabella alone, and for them to flee, because there is something not quite right about her. Now, this episode is a really good one to end the series on. It's got some high-octane scare moments weaving around this classic gothic tale, albeit with some unusual twists and ideas. But one of the most effective aspects of this story is Dorabella herself, who really strikes the perfect balance between being beautiful and unsettling. I don't know what it is about the women they picked for this series and for some of these other BFI ones that I talked about, but like Pauline Moran in the last episode, these women can manage to exude menace and threat with just a facial expression without the need for elaborate makeup or prosthetics. They're just very good at like looking creepy. Now, when Dorabella starts to show off her magical tricks and insists that the two men travel on to the next inn and then the next inn and the next, though they must take her luggage, but she will not go with them. She'll just turn up and meet them at the next inn. There is clearly something odd going on. Now, this episode is probably the most epic in terms of scale. The characters travel to multiple locations, and there's a lot more outdoor location shots in this than in any of the other episodes of Supernatural. And there's also a bunch of visual trickery and effects that make it feel a little more in your face than the other episodes. It really sort of pulls the boat out a little bit in terms of, like scary scares. But it also got some cool, subtle scares too. And one of the creepiest moments is at the start, when the men first meet Dorabella at this inn. And there's this poet there, and he's leaning up against a mantelpiece with a mandolin or a lute-type instrument. And at one point, he starts to recite a poem called We Are Seven, which was written by William Wordsworth. That was published in around 1798. Now, this poem is just a discussion, basically. If you read the poem itself, you can, you know, go on Wikipedia or something, read the poem. It's basically just an adult and a little girl, and they're chatting, and the adult is asking, this is the poet, it's based on a real-life event, apparently, that Wordsworth had when he bumped into a little girl, and he asks her, you know, how many brothers and sisters you got? Simple question. And the central idea of the poem is whether you should count your dead siblings as part of that number. And so the little girl insists that there are seven in her family because she counts her two dead siblings. And in the poem, she chats about how she often goes to sit with the dead ones by their graveside. She says this in part of the poem. She says, my stockings there I often knit, my kerchief there I hem, and there upon the ground I sit and sing to them. And often after sunset, sir, when it is light and fair, I take my little porringer and eat my supper there. And so the poem itself is a sort of sweet idea, with hints of darkness perhaps. But all in all, you get the impression of a cute little girl who doesn't see death as being a barrier to companionship and family. And so it's quite a nice poem. It's the perfect sentiment, though, for a story like Dorabella. You see, here the poet in the inn starts to recite this poem while staring at Dorabella, and the way he does it wrenches all of the cuteness out of Wordsworth's poem and turns it into a very dark and creepy ballad about companionship with the dead. And that is just like an ideal thing to say. I think it's a very clever move to include it in this story. Let me play a little bit of this poem to you from Supernatural, just to give you an idea of the creepy angle they take with it.
The first that died was little Jane. In bed she moaning lay, till God released her from her pain, and then she went away. So in the churchyard she was laid, and when the grass was dry, together round her grave we played, my brother John and I. When the ground was white with snow, and I could run and sly, my brother John was forced to go, and he lies by her side. How many are you then, said I, if they too are in heaven? The little maiden did reply, O master, we are seven. But they are dead, those two are dead, their spirits are in heaven. heaven. It was throwing words away. For still the little maid would have her will, and said, "Nay, we are seven."
Also, I would say, if you like watching people eat soup, this is definitely the episode for you, because there is this scene in it, right, where these two men are sitting with Dora Bella, and they're eating soup while this amorous-looking servant girl keeps hovering around the table, delivering bits of food and pouring out coffee or whatever. And the scene just seems to go on for, like, ever. Like, much longer than you'd ever see in a TV show these days. And just people not speaking, just, you know, eating up their soup. But the tension mounts up, and the scene does end with a really effective little payoff. Now, when the travelers eventually get to their destination, basically the place where Dora Bella has been guiding them all this time, the set is vast and epic, and the ending pulls us into a strange and scary conclusion to the episode in the series. Listen, I haven't given that much away about it. It might sound like I have, but I haven't really. It's a good episode to watch. I enjoyed it. One thing to add, though, I did spot a laugh-out-loud blooper 39 minutes into this episode. The smitten Walter Van Lamont has this disagreement with his friend Philip, and then he vigorously pulls at his bedroom door. If you watch carefully, you'll see him literally rip half the door handle and the lock off the door, though the camera cuts away and obviously nobody bursts out laughing. Well, apart from me. Now, one other thing to add is that this episode stars Jeremy Clyde as the starstruck Walter Van Lamont, and also Michael Miller as Dora Bella's father. Now, Clyde was Shulkin in Shulkin the Painter, and I'm sure that Miller was the creepy Vanderhausen from that same film. So it's nice to see them back together, keeping things creepy. Miller certainly has a way with the spooky facial expression. It's not all looked after by the women. The men are able to do that in these series too. And so Dora Bella brings us to the end of not only the disc Supernatural, the two-disc set, but also to this entire bundle of particular BFI releases. And you'll see, of course, looking back on these three episodes, no doubt that, strictly speaking, the programmes are not specifically all about ghosts as such. Some spill over into the general gothic territory, but on the whole, there is a definite ghostly supernatural sense to all of these programmes and all that they offer. One other common thread in most of these discs, with the exception of the M.R. James stuff, is that so many of them seem to explore sexuality, gender roles, and sexual repression, with hints of sexual deviance, particularly in the series Supernatural, with the necrophilia and the incest ideas on show. And so it makes, I think, for a very thought-provoking set of discs, as well as a set of creepy ones. But as I draw to a conclusion, I would say that, you know what, I think it's the very medium itself that makes these BFI DVDs stand out from so much horror that I watch these days. And I just don't mean the modern stuff, I mean the retro re-release stuff. You see, to watch BBC drama, or any TV drama of the time, but particularly with this, it's to talk in a television language that is barely even recognisable today. The pace of these discs, as I've already said, is incredibly slow at times, and I honestly think that some people listening to this, some of you guys will just not understand the attraction I had to this stuff, because it is so meandering for many viewers and so talky. I think in the majority of my friends that I have who prefer mainstream cinema and TV would just ultimately scratch their heads at watching this stuff and would label it as elitist and pompous and ultimately mind-numbingly boring. The cameras in the shows are largely static, with only occasional movements. The editing is slow and the very opposite of the frantic cutting you might see in a film like The Great Gatsby with Leonardo DiCaprio that just came out. And, you know, these shows that we're watching here are the pre-music video age, and it shows. But also, as I mentioned in my review for Ghosts of Venice, there is a clear and unapologetic sense that these are sets with actors who are spouting incredibly literary-sounding and clearly, importantly, clearly written dialogue. It's clear that this is written. I mean, you'll listen to people talking on this show, on these shows, and you'll think, people are not as naturally poetic or profound as this in real life. Hey, maybe you have friends who are, but I don't, you know, I don't talk like this normally, and most people don't. They are just, like, when you compare the way these people talk to a modern TV show like Homeland or something that strives for a sense of realism among the sometimes outlandish plots, you realize that these dramas are like from another planet. I suppose something like Downton Abbey, which is very popular, tries to recreate some of this more literary way of talking. But I just feel like these shows, particularly Supernatural, but all of them really are just on another level in terms of sort of these literary aspirations to the script. Yet, you might think that the lack of documentary-style realism would make all of this stuff just feel too fictional for it to be affecting. But you know what's interesting? In some ways, it's the opposite that is true. The over-the-top theatrical nature of these shows pull you into nothing less than pure drama. Like, that's what it is. It's drama. Like, settling down to these DVDs is like a night at the theatre. And the themes and the clearly obvious sets and the performances, the very actory performances, have this habit of somehow burrowing into your psyche in a way that some modern TV just can't do it. And I would say if you want a creepy, profound, political, philosophical, theatrical, gothic Christmas, I really suggest you look no further. Only be warned, patient viewers need only apply. Well, that's it for my roundup of the BFI DVDs of Dead of Night, Shulk and the Painter, classic ghost stories by M.R. James, and the anthology series Supernatural. But I'd rather you not go home just yet. I'd like to chat to you for a little while longer. I know it's getting late, but as I've said, not all of these BFI discs discuss ghosts, but many of them do. And so isn't it worth us, despite the late hour, isn't it worth us considering how ghosts might possibly fit into theology and God? Is there a place for the unquiet dead in the realms of the Christian supernatural? Join me next time to find out. But until then, don't forget to follow me on Twitter at RevPeterLaws or email contact us at theflicksthechurchforgot.com. And of course, join the Facebook page at the Flicks the Church Forgot. But until next time, be careful the company you keep. You never know how long they've been dead. And don't forget, the Flicks the Church Forgot.